This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you and a whole array of experts on the show today, starting with parenting, specifically how screen time is really, really, data showing us, detrimental to developing brains. We were in conversation with Dr. Alison Burrows. She is a professor of education. She's also a parenting coach and expert. And she was unpacking what those numbers say, some realistic ways to reduce screen time, and understanding the four pillars from losing sleep to lowering concentration levels. We're also talking all things gastro with Dr. Usama from Genesis. What do we need to know? When do you need to go to hospital? And can celiac be misdiagnosed? Meeting the team behind a teen internship fair that's happening over the weekend. Why can your teen really benefit for some real life experience? And in Pets and Vets, it was Dr. Sarah Ramsey on hand as we talked about the health impact of the unstable weather on our furry friends. And of course, taking your questions too. We are talking about the effects of screen time on the developing brain. And if you ask any parent about the time their kids spend on mobile devices, you'll probably hear the same refrain, which is, it's too much. Excessive use of smartphones and social media in particular, linked undeniably, according to data, to rising rates of teenage depression, self-harm, and also damaging students' academic performance and exacerbating these achievement gaps as well. At this point, the question isn't really whether phones should be banned from classrooms, but why aren't more schools doing it already? Evidence about the negative effects of mobile devices on learning is overwhelming, so we are bringing in the expert. She is a professor at Middlesex University, Dubai. She's a certified parenting coach, a child development expert, crucially a parent who has a tween, and I'm sure some of these conversations very real. So Dr. Alison Burrows joining us today. How are you, Dr. Alison?
I'm very well, thank you.
I find this quite an emotive topic.
Yes.
As a parent.
It's very triggering.
And as a person whose phone, well, your phone's next to you, my phone's within arm's reach of me. And as I went to work this morning, the girls were like, when we get home this afternoon, we haven't got any activities. Can we have a little bit of iPad time? Because mine don't use iPads during the week. They're only allowed their iPads at the weekend. Apart from last week with distance learning, that was a nice twist.
Right.
And it's really hard to get the balance as a parent of having your kids plugged in socially, academically, and not have these situations where I'm sure a lot of parents listening and watching today will understand of the wrestling the device out of their hand and tantrums that can ensue. You say that now, more than ever, parents need deeper connections with our children.
Yes, absolutely.
Screen time proven to have negative effects on the developing brain. Can we talk a little bit about that really dark side that I touched on? You know, the research findings linking screen time to rise in suicidal thoughts and tendencies, especially in that younger adolescent group.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, the data is very clear, sadly, and the data about the rise in early adolescent, teenage, and also very young adult increase in suicide, increase in self-harm, increase in diagnosed depression and anxiety. These studies have been replicated many, many times in many different populations across the world, in particularly the English-speaking world. And I do believe Dubai is part of that English-speaking world. Mm-hmm. So the data is real now and it is confirmed. And we can't really turn a blind eye to this anymore. This is a public health crisis.
Can I ask you as a professor a little bit about how these studies work?
Sure.
Because I'm yet in my 40 odd years on this planet, I'm yet to meet someone who's like, oh, we took part in a study and the data is out now.
Right.
You know, do you know what I mean? I feel like it's like this like mysterious thing that happens behind closed doors. And
well, it does. So, there's a huge disconnect between a university and the rest of the world. Yeah.
So in studies such as this, where we are linking screen time to some really, really negative outcomes, what is the counter? What kind of studies are done? Is it a case of we are going to put a child in front of an iPad and they can go on TikTok for 6 6 hours a day, and then we're going to track and see, you know, the effects on their mental health. How would a study like that work?
Right. So that would not be a study because it would be unethical. No ethical approval board would allow a researcher to put a young child in front of TikTok for 6 hours and study the effects. So what these studies are collecting are data from parents. How many hours a day does your child watch TikTok? How many hours a day does your child use different social media? And then the studies are combined with other information like, does your child self-report feeling depressed? Does your child self-report feeling anxiety?
Sleep patterns that you might be
how
noticing.
Much is your, right. Okay. How often is your child engaging with friends in the real world?
In 3D.
Embodied, what we call embodied experiences, mm-hmm. where they're actually inside their bodies with their friends who are inside their bodies in the same space.
Yeah. So which aspects then in particular of social media, let's bring gaming in there as well, mm-hmm. contribute to the negative effects of the developing brain? Can we kind of really drill down what is so damaging to the brain in particular about what they're using it and for how long as well, Doctor?
Right. Okay. So it's not just one variable. It's not just social media or gaming. This all really started when children began to play much less in childhood. There are three things a child should do. One is play, two is play, and three is play. Children are not engaging in play enough. We saw the decline of play happen very rapidly in the 1990s, again, all over the first world, English-speaking world. And then in the 2007s, 2010s, all of a sudden everyone has a phone or a smartphone or some kind of access to device. So now they're even playing less. Mm. And then what are they looking at on devices? They're looking on social media. Social media perpetuates social comparison. For a developing brain that is trying to figure out its own identity, which happens a lot in the prepubescent teenage years, we now have children who don't have a childhood based in play and who have to manage their brand online while their brain is going through this huge transition of rewiring, which happens in the teenage years.
For those who aren't watching on Facebook, I just recoiled at the word brand. The thought of a tween thinking about what is my brand? Who am I, you know, in the school setting? Who am I in a social media setting?
Yeah.
Because that's the human nature, isn't it? I want to belong. I want to be in a tribe. I don't want to be alone and isolated because that's where you get picked off.
Exactly. And that's so critical during those teenage years because teenagerhood is the transition to adulthood. So this is when the child learns to be independent, right? But this is also when the child learns to be part of a social group because when we were early humans, we survived through strong relationships and social groups. So the brain is wiring itself to become a parent, but also to be part of that group for safety.
There's so much to unpack here. And as I said, already messages coming in. Dr. Alison Burrows is with us today. She's a professor at Middlesex University, certified parenting coach, parent as well, of course, herself. So let us know your thoughts on this. Is this data? And the numbers are pretty overwhelming. We're going to be looking at further into those details next. Is that compelling enough for you as a parent to say smartphones are not going to be crossing the threshold? Is it would be enough for you to say we're going to be reducing usage? Girls born after 1995, so the first teens to own smartphones, have, quote, higher suicide rates than any previous generation on record in all five of the major English-speaking countries. And that is before you consider specific smartphone-related issues such as access to violent explicit videos, cyberbullying, reduced focus, sleep loss. So it is hardly surprising then that the last few weeks in the UK has seen an explosion of grassroots parent-led movements. Smartphone-free childhood has more than 20,000 WhatsApp members, and Delay Smartphones has thousands of parents pledging to wait until their kids turn 14 before giving them smartphones. Let us know your take on that. Are you delaying it? Have you got any questions, any concerns? Or do you feel like technology is an integral part of your child's life and taking that phone away could be holding them back? Let's hear now from Claire Ferniehoff. She is the co-founder of Smartphone-Free Childhood. childhood.
It's absolutely fine for children to have a phone, but investment needs to be put into a what we would call a brick phone or a dumb phone for children. Smartphones are not good for them. We know now, we have enough data, because the people who got smartphones as children are not adults, and we know that the younger a child gets a smartphone, the worse their mental health is. It's very clear in the evidence. So I think the investment needs to switch into giving really cool brick phones for children that they can text and call on. But they don't need to do any more than that. From my perspective, the only reason a child needs a smartphone is because everyone else has got one. And that is the norm that we are trying to change.
Smartphone-free childhood is going to be in the UAE, and we will, of course, be catching up with them very soon indeed. Dr. Alison Burrows is with us today. She's a professor of Middlesex University. She's a certified parenting coach, child development expert, and mum as well. Taking my questions and yours on the text line, one just come in here saying, after hearing an interview with Jennifer Garner, who has told her daughter, show me the evidence that suggests a positive effect on having your own phone, a 16-year-old couldn't and accepted it wasn't in her interest. I say the same to my tween. Can I ask you a personal question, Doctor?
Yes.
You've got a 9-year-old daughter, as do I. What are your boundaries, guidelines, rules when it comes to tech and device usage in your home?
Recently, they have gotten a lot stricter. So my doctoral work is on meaningful learning with technology for primary school children. So I've been so focused on the learning aspect of technology and how we can leverage technology for kids to learn in a meaningful way, which, by the way, the data is not good. Mm-hmm. Now I focus to, okay, what do parents need to know about generally children's interactions with screens? And as I've more recently gotten more deeply into this research, I have limited her screen time a lot more. She does have a flip phone. She has a flip phone for communication and transportation purposes because I'm a full-time working mom. However, in terms of her iPad, which she needs for school, there's no such thing as an iPad-free school yet, which is also why there are no smartphone-free schools yet. But in terms of her iPad, she is allowed Netflix Kids. She's allowed YouTube Kids, but she's allowed that with a grown-up in the room watching alongside of her, talking about the content with her.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, more messages coming in here on this topic saying, it's really hard. It's really, mm-hmm. really hard. Talking about Liliane saying a ban is unrealistic. You know, IDs are on our phones. You need to prepare your kids for that adult world. How to safely use their phone, how to safely use AI.
Yeah, but okay, we need to prepare our adults for the adult world. We don't let them anywhere near cigarettes, right? We don't let them drive a car until they're like, you know, the research is very clear now, which is why also I'm going to be reducing my daughter's access to YouTube Kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I have to say, YouTube has now been banned in our household, mainly because I was watching it going, this is dross. You're watching some moron on the other side of the world making slime or doing pranks.
Right.
And if they're not selling you something, you're being sold. You're the product, your eyeballs, your time, your attention. You are a commodity.
Right.
And I've noticed over the last few years, my attention span is in the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these YouTube shorts where the kids are watching like videos that are 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds. And it's what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? What does that do to the brain?
So YouTube uses an algorithm to keep your child addicted. Because what YouTube does is it knows your child and it provides them with content that they want to see that's incredibly engaging for them. So every time a new video comes on, they get a dopamine hit in their brain. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's most closely associated with addiction. Excessive levels of dopamine throughout long periods of childhood can actually affect how the brain is wired. It actually affects optimal brain development. So a constant dopamine hit from gaming, from like buttons, from retweets, from whatever it be on social media, can actually affect how the child's brain is wired.
And then presumably the more tolerance you have to dopamine, the more you need in order to get that hit.
That's right. Yes. So the more you need to get that hit, but also the harder it is for you as a parent to get your child off that device.
Which is what we're going to be coming to next. Dr. Alison Burrows is with us today. We're going to be talking about the four foundational harms of screens: sleep deprivation, social deprivation, attention fragmentation, which has been touching on there, and addiction. In conversation today with Dr. Alison Burrows, Professor at Middlesex University. She's a certified parenting coach, a child development expert. She's also a mum. And she says now more than ever, parents need deeper connections with their children as screen time is proven to have negative effects on the developing brain. From tots up to teens, let us know your thoughts on that. We've had questions, we've got comments, we've got some people who really need some advice. And this is Emily, who's sharing her thoughts as a mum of three.
Hi Helen, it's Emily. I'm a mum of three. My eldest is starting secondary school in September. So I've done a lot of research in the past few weeks. And my intuition is telling me to hold off. We've decided not to get our daughter a smartphone in year seven. I'm actually in the very minority of parents who are doing that. I've done actually a small poll in the class a few weeks ago. And it's something that, I don't know, I feel really strongly about. Social media and screen time is actually something that makes my life more stressful and gives anxiety. So I'm not sure about giving access to the children that early on. So we're going to try and hold off until she's 13, and we will see how that goes. It's such a tricky issue because we have so much more research now being done on the impact of, you know, social media and smartphones and access to the internet to children and teenagers. And I feel like what we were doing 5-6 years ago, now, you know, we're a bit more clarity on the impact, and I think maybe, you know, things can start changing now that we are more aware of the impact. So that's how I feel, and that's what we've decided. But it's such a kind of tricky kind of issue, because there's nothing wrong with, you know, what you decide as a parent to do for your children. But I think the main thing is just to be informed and do some research before you make decisions, and then you can make an informed decision. So that's what we've decided to do. And my gut feeling, my intuition is telling me that we should hold off.
Emily there speaking about their decision as a family, waiting until 13 for a smartphone. But as she alluded to there, in the minority, Dr. Alison, you know, did a poll and having spoken to people, I think that social pressure is really, really hard for parents. And then to have that, you know, that conversation with kids as well, because kids compare. He has this, she has that. Why can't I do that? How on earth can you kind of stay strong in your convictions when you feel like you really are, you know, standing alone?
Well, there are a few ways. So the first thing that I've noticed in terms of parenting and how parenting has shifted is that parents are not comfortable when their child is uncomfortable. Parents have to learn how to be comfortable when their child is uncomfortable so that they can maintain their boundaries. And boundaries should always come from values. So I talk about this a lot in my parenting coaching and parenting classes. So when your child is uncomfortable and showing big emotions because you took the screen away or you won't allow the screen time, that's okay. Allow your child to feel that. Allow the child to be uncomfortable. Get used to it. Mm. The other thing is find your tribe. Your child probably has a lot of friends. If your child has 5 very close friends, I guarantee you 1 or 2 mothers and fathers in that group of friends are thinking the same thing you are. And you make a pact with these other parents that our kids are not getting access to social media or iPhones until they're 16.
Why is 16 a kind of a pivotal number to your mind as an expert?
Based on brain development, based on the fact that the prefrontal cortex and the cortex, the part of the brain that is responsible for self-regulation, self-management, critical thinking, sequencing, executive function, that part of the brain is not developed completely until a person is 25 years old. So because of that fact, because the brain is still going through these executive function skills, 16 seems to be, and this is not right for every child, of course, the age where social media can be less, you know, harmful for them.
Dr. Alison Burrows is with us today. She is a professor of education at Middlesex University, parenting coach, child development expert, and a mum, which I think is really important to mention. Can we talk about what is referred to as the 4 foundational harms of screens, sleep deprivation, social deprivation, attention fragmentation, and addiction. I love talking about sleep. I find it fascinating. When it comes to screen time and our children in particular, whether they are teeny little toddlers or teenagers, what is happening in the brain due to screen time that can really impact sleep, Doctor?
Well, it's very activating screen time, very, very activating. So the brain has a much harder time calming down after being on a screen, especially a screen where the images are changing very quickly, like a SpongeBob SquarePants kind of a cartoon. But we're finding that the sleep deprivation is really, really dramatic for preteens and teens who are on social media and chat groups instead of going to sleep. Sleep is critically important because that is when the brain does all that magical stuff that needs to happen. Information moves from the working memory to the long-term memory when we are sleeping. The body grows and develops when we are sleeping.
Listen, any doctor that prescribes sleep is all right in my book, Alison.
Yes.
From the UK, a head teacher in Notting Hill says children's 100% obsession with devices is creating an apathetic generation that cannot hold conversations or make eye contact. So coming to that point too, social deprivation, how can parents encourage in-person rich interactions to counterbalance some of the effects of screen time?
Yeah, play dates. I always organize play dates for my child as much as possible, joining sports teams, working in groups, getting them outside and running around. Play, play, play. Maybe for an adolescent, they're not playing, but they're hanging out. They're going to the mall together. They're going to the pizzeria together. Because what we're finding is on social media, kids unfriend people just like that. But in the real world, kids need to learn how to negotiate difficult situations. This is how we have grown-ups who can contribute to societies. But now on social media, they're unfriending each other. They're turning each other off. They're completely disregarding each other.
I've never thought about that before.
Yeah.
We need to be able to resolve conflict, need to have difficult conversations.
We need to solve problems.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. We touched on it before, attention fragmentation, which I think a lot of people listening today as adults will probably identify with. But, you know, we're constantly, you know, our attention's being competed for. Big screens, small screens, various emails, inboxes, notifications, ping, 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 ping. Why is it particularly detrimental to a young developing brain?
Because the young developing brain is wiring. Those networks and neurotransmitters in the brain that are in charge of attention and focus are not being wired properly if they're not given a chance to actually focus and pay attention for a long period of time. 100% of the teachers that I teach at my Masters of Education program at Middlesex are telling me that when their kids are on iPad and supposed to be doing an activity on the iPad, they're also in chat rooms on Facebook and doing other things. We call this digital multitasking. So while we think they're learning, their learning is very much interrupted. So this isn't just affecting them emotionally, it's affecting them academically as well.
I feel like, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it's really fascinating. For anyone that enjoys talking about films and books, it's called The Rest is Entertainment. It's Richard Osman, who wrote all sorts of crime novels, and he's very into TV, and there's a journalist, Marina Hind, on it. And they were talking about how TV and movie production is changing because of what they call the second screen. Yes. So there'll be plot lines which they'll go, well, it's not really suitable for that second screen, because they expect people, as so many of us do, to watch something while also having our phone in our hand, whether that's playing a game or messaging people. It's really fascinating to think how, you know, society and entertainment and so many different things are responding, reacting, changing to how we use technology. The fourth foundational harm is addiction. I'm going to actually ask you to kind of illustrate that by answering a question that's come in from Scylla, who says, our six-year-old gets genuine rage when we say iPad time is over. Should we go cold turkey? He's mostly watching YouTube Kids and plays a maths game.
No, don't go cold turkey. If your child was a drug addict, right, we don't just have them go cold turkey. We put other supports in place when a person is, or a child is, withdrawing from something. But it's even harder for kids because the areas in their brain are still developing. So this is a very, very complex conversation and a very complex way to train parents, which I do. However, start giving the child transitions. 10 more minutes of YouTube, 8 more minutes of YouTube, 5 more minutes of YouTube, 4 more minutes of YouTube, and then we're going to play Legos together. 3 more minutes of YouTube, and then we will have ice cream together, right?
Yeah, you can choose something that we'll play. We'll get a message here saying, what about books, escaping through books? And then you can go and choose something from the shelf. Yes. Message here from Adam saying, my daughter's mother and I are divorced. She's 7. I can't wait until she gets her own phone so at least I can be in touch with her on the days I don't see her. It'll be a wonderful lifeline for me to be able to text and say, hey, I'm thinking of you. I love you. On the days I don't see her. It is tricky about internet access, though.
Yes, get her a flip phone. Get her a flip phone.
Let's go Nokia. Let's go old school.
Yeah, that's what my daughter has. She has a flip phone. She can call me when she needs me.
Dr. Alison Burrows, I feel like we could have talked about this for a whole lot longer, but you know, with just a minute left, what do you feel like the most important takeaway is for the people listening today that we haven't touched on yet when it comes to the brain, screen time, and our kids in particular? What do we really need to know?
The way that the child's brain forms optimally is through play, an embodied play, an uninterrupted free range play without the parent structuring the play. Our kids are overstructured. We're helicopter parenting, right? We're protecting them so much in the real world, but we're not protecting them enough in the online world.
Thank you so much for your time. If anyone wants to do a bit of a deep dive into some of the work that you've been doing, reach out for any parenting advice or coaching. What's the best way of getting in touch with you, Alison?
You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Alison Parenting, dr.alison parenting. And I also have a website, www.dralisonparenting.com. And I'm at Middlesex University, Dubai.
Thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you.
I think a lot of people having a big think right now, including myself, about how we navigate an ever-changing and ever-complicated situation. But as we touched on, the data there is absolutely irrefutable. Joining us from Genesis Healthcare, we are delighted to welcome to the studio consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist Dr. Usuma Warshaw. And you are a very busy man, year round, recently moved to Genesis. And I have to say, when I heard you'd moved, I was like, oh, great. I've heard so many good things. I want to say good things. I've had many friends in distress, whether it's their own gastro issues or those of their children. And your name just comes up again and again and again in WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups of being really wonderful and safe hands and lovely. And I think always think it's you should tell people things like that. So I just want to say thank you for your time today. How are you?
Oh, thank you very much, Helen. It's really a pleasure to be here.
I want to know why you wanted to work in this field of medicine.
I think positive influences, actually. Really, that was what it was. I think early on in my training, it was just very positive influences from mentors. And I just it took to it directly. It's an interesting specialty.
I can imagine.
The kind of things we do.
Well, what are some of the things that are keeping you busy? What's coming into clinic? You've been in the UAE now for around 8 years. But, you know, have you noticed any trends, any changes? Are you looking at your calendar and going, oh, another one of that?
I think we see a lot of what we call functional gastrointestinal problems.
What does that mean?
Gastroenterology is very varied.
Huge.
We see a lot of different cases, but a lot of our workload is functional conditions. These are conditions, for example, like indigestion, which is often called dyspepsia, irritable bowel syndrome. Reflux is a very common issue.
I only think of reflux in babies.
No, it's very common in adults.
Really? They're
extremely common. And there's a wide array of conditions we deal with. And of course, you know, there are also liver conditions we deal with. We see a lot of patients with fatty liver and other liver conditions. So it's quite varied,
No day is the same. We've got Dr. Usuma with us today. If you've got any questions for him, and as I said already, text line very, very busy indeed. Get in touch. You don't have to put your name on it if you would rather not. Now, there have been some concerns about the unstable weather leading to some gastro issues, whether that is through exposure to dirty water, whether that is drinking it or touching it, you know, putting your hand in your mouth, and this dysentery being kind of thrown around quite a lot, which I always sounds like, it sounds like something from like Victorian times. from a medical point of view, what are we talking about?
I mean, dysentery, it brings to mind a lot of different things, often drastic condition. But I think medically we have to remember that what we're defining here is foodborne food poisoning, essentially. And in medical terms, we call this gastroenteritis. Mm-hmm. But there are many variations of severity of gastroenteritis. The majority of people who get gastroenteritis or inflammation due to infection, it's mild. It lasts a couple of days. We've all had it. And it goes on its own without sort of just conservative treatment. But the other end of the spectrum is dysentery. Mm-hmm. That's when you get really severe symptoms, you're extremely unwell, you have fever, and so a lot of other very adverse symptoms and often require attention in the hospital. Typically, dysentery is related to bacterial infections. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard of Salmonella and Campylobacter and E. coli. These are the kind of bacteria that can cause dysentery.
To the text line, we've got lots of people who want your time and your expert advice. Yeah. Esther says, what should you do if your child has a gastro episode and can't keep anything down? Is there anything going around right now? It's been 24 hours. Esther, my daughter was in hospital about 2 weeks ago with, as you say, a gastro episode. And it was just sick everywhere, to be honest. In our household, it was grim. Now, saying there that, you know, sometimes these things pass, with children, it can be quite worrying because they can become, you know, quite dehydrated and quite unwell quite quickly. What do you tend to advise if it's a child in particular, doctor?
I think in younger children, you have to be quite cautious, particularly below the age of 5. But I think the important thing to remember, Ellen, is that gastroenteritis or these vomiting and diarrhea bugs are very common all year round. I know we are seeing a spike because of the extreme flooding and the stagnant waters and possibly contamination of water and risk, but they are common conditions. And if you do have your child who's vomiting, I think it's about seeing how long it lasts for. Are they managed to keep any fluid down or small amounts of fluid down, and just being sensible and seeking help from the hospital when it's needed? But in general, majority of the time with vomiting, diarrhea bugs, you can manage it just by rehydrating, taking rest, and ensuring that you have, you know, particular rehydration with salty, glucose-type drinks and eating very bland food and having it over small periods of time and having small amounts can usually get you through it. But obviously, if it persists and you can't keep anything down and this child's showing signs of dehydration, then, of course, yeah, be sensible and seek help from the hospital.
I don't know if you're going to have a kind of scientific answer to this, but why do some people have like an ironclad stomach and never get struck down by gastro issues or food poisoning? My dad's always like, yeah, you know, I've got a stomach like a Viking, you know, like no problems at all, whereas some people do tend to be quite prone to, you know, nausea, gastro problems. They might have something that's a little bit dodgy and it can take them out for a week. Is there any kind of biological reasons or demographics of people that are pretty sturdy stomach-wise?
Very interesting question. And I think this variability in how strong our stomachs are, I don't think there's any easy explanation for it. But when you look at it in terms of patients who have underlying gastroenterological conditions, a common one is irritable bowel syndrome, extremely common. Mm-hmm. You look at 1 in 3 people have it. Patients who have IBS, they have very sensitive stomachs. If they go and get gastroenteritis, they're much more prone to prolonged illness and more pronounced symptoms. And of course, there are other gastroenterological conditions which make it more likely that you will suffer more heavily. But in terms of the healthy people who don't have underlying illnesses, it's difficult to say why one person has a very sensitive stomach and another has sort of, as you said, an ironclad stomach that can take anything on.
Good old dad, he'll eat anything. It's interesting. We are going to be talking about IBS very soon indeed, because there is an author who's written a book on that topic. So, well, we'll save any questions for her. But in the meantime, we've had messages here saying, can children grow out of celiac disease and can it be misdiagnosed? We've had a question about SIBO, SIBO. I'm sure Dr. Osama can put me right on that. Anonymous asking, I've had to take 3 doses of antibiotics in the last 2 months and I am so bloated. Could it be related? Is it too late for a probiotic? Talking tummy troubles now with Dr. Osama Washer. Well, he's a consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist at Genesis Healthcare Centre. We've been talking there about dealing with dysentery, about how exposure to bacteria, can be managed at home. But when it gets serious, it might be time for a trip to the hospital. To the text line we go. And you said earlier some of the issues, conditions that you're treating, no day is the same, pardon me. Well, the text line is very varied as well. Anonymous message here saying, a few weeks ago, I tested positive for SIBO after years and years of suffering daily gut issues and being told it's IBS and or anxiety. From everything I've read about it, it looks like a really difficult and stubborn thing to treat. So I'm feeling a bit disheartened. Would welcome any advice from your lovely doctor. So what is SIBO and any advice for this listener, doctor?
So SIBO stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is a bit of a mouthful. Essentially, SIBO is a condition where your own internal bacteria, which is called our gut microbiome, becomes unstable or imbalanced, where you tend to get a lot more bacteria in the small intestine, where it usually isn't present. Most of it is in the colon, the large intestine. And when this happens, it can actually give you a lot of symptoms, particularly bloating, although the symptoms can be very varied. The thing about SIBO is that it can coexist with other conditions. So it doesn't necessarily mean you can have SIBO exclusively. You might have SIBO and IBS, which is a very common combination. So I think to the listener, it might be that she does still have IBS, but it's been complicated by SIBO. Hence the if you like, the disappointment that the antibiotics didn't work. Typically with SIBO, we do use very specific types of treatment to try and help the overgrowth, if you like, for the small intestine, such as using antibiotics or very specialized antibiotics. And cycling them. Hence the reason why she's had multiple courses. But probiotics additionally can be used. So she could consider more a different array of probiotics as an option, or maybe even ask a gastroenterologist whether this may be two conditions.
With your permission, yes. Can I share your details with this listener?
Absolutely.
Okay, yes. Dr. Summer with us today. With that antibiotic thing in mind, how do you, as a as a doctor, as a dad, if there is antibiotics that need to be taken, how do you prepare your gut before, during, and after to repair and kind of get back to normal?
This is a very interesting, very good question, actually, because we don't know what happens to this gut microbiome, these millions of bacteria in our colon, which is providing a great benefit to us in terms of coexisting with our gut and producing different proteins and vitamins and helping us in so many ways. We don't know what happens with antibiotics in terms of which parts of that gut microbiome gets damaged or interrupted or wiped out. But typically, it's very hard to say. Mm-hmm. But in some circumstances, there is some evidence to use probiotics preemptively, meaning when you start a course of antibiotics, you take probiotics, which are essentially like live bacteria, to try and counter the effect of what the antibiotics are going to do to your gut microbiome.
Just get the timing right on the taking of them. A message here saying, can children grow out of celiac disease and can celiac disease be misdiagnosed?
Oh, very good question. I think celiac disease, firstly to say celiac, extremely common and very under-recognized, unfortunately, and it's not tested for enough. And the thing about it is it can affect patients from a very young age to very old patients. And a diagnostic suspicion is very important as both a physician and a gastroenterologist. Mm-hmm. So the first question in terms of can you grow out of it? Yeah, there are cases of pediatric patients growing out of celiac disease. But I think the most important thing is when that happens, it's causing the transition to adult gastroenterology and continue to be followed up to make sure it isn't the case. But yes, that does happen. In terms of misdiagnosis, yes, it can be misdiagnosed. And the flip side of it is celiac can be very difficult to diagnose. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very intricate and careful about how you diagnose it in the first place.
Is it something that you do in clinic?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. I mean, we see a lot of celiac disease because it's common worldwide.
Again, to this listener, I will send you Dr. Osama's details. Okay. We've got time for one last question before a bit of Steve Winwood. I'm actually saying, can you kindly ask the doctor about how important vitamin D is for our gut health? Interesting. Yeah. Vitamin D seems to be talked about in all sorts of things, from sleep and mental health and all sorts. How does it relate to the gut?
Vitamin D, there was a vogue that vitamin D was affected in terms of many of our body processes, including the gut. I think generally vitamins and minerals are important for our gut function. In terms of vitamin D, there are some studies that say it's important for our general gut health, our gut microbiome, but it's mainly a vitamin that's involved in bone metabolism.
Immune system, and
it can be one of those general supplements that can help, but in terms of sort of solid science and evidence, there isn't strong evidence that it sort of prevents certain gastroenterological diseases or used to treat certain diseases.
My very last question to you, and it's a question I always ask doctors, because I know what you're going to say, which is, you as a gastroenterologist, is there anything that you do or take or avoid or adjust that we could learn from, so we haven't got to go to medical school, but we can avail of your insights, to have the healthiest tummy possible?
Yeah, I think part of the question is a boring answer, because
it's going to be leafy greens, isn't it? It's always leafy greens.
Fruits and vegetables and taking enough exercise and drinking enough fluid, because these are important. The gut is linked to the whole part of our body in every way. So when you're moving and you're eating well, your gut health is good. But you can do things. You can improve or try to improve gut health by taking simple things like prebiotics, which are good sources of fiber found in fruit and vegetables. I think it's very much
the simple stuff. Stop smoking, get good sleep, drink lots of water.
Absolutely.
Healthy berry diet. I secretly hope that one day one doctor to turn around and go, well, there is this supplement and it costs 10 dirhams and it's going to change your life. So if you could start working on that for me, Dr. Sama.
We'll be waiting for that one.
Thank you so much. In the meantime, though, you can be found at Genesis. With your permission, if anyone wants to send me the word health, I'll share your details.
Sure.
And you do work with pediatrics all the way through.
I work from 14 years.
14.
From 14
Perfect.
Upwards.
You're a star. Thank you so much, Dr. Sama Washaw, speaking to us in the studio. Talking teens now, and a study conducted by Bait.com surveyed over 2,400 respondents around the MENA region showed that 78% of companies expressed interest in hiring interns in 2023. So the world has responded. The UAE's first ever teen internship fair, Unihawk Teen Launchpad, is happening this weekend. It's open to students aged between 15 and 18. We've got the founder of the RM events, Viti Shah, with us today, and grade 11 student, Zina Merchant, in the studio too. I always think about my own internship days and how it kind of differentiates from work experience, and how actually it's been quite a challenging space for teens over the last few years, Vidi in particular, thinking about COVID and, you know, balancing responsibilities of work and school and all the rest of it. I wanted to ask you about the inspiration behind creating this event and how you think it's going to empower the youth.
Wonderful. Thank you for having both of us. Zena and myself are highly obliged. And we are overwhelmed with the response. And the inspiration is exactly from where you started off. We are a group of mothers who started off this initiative. And we are mothers of teenagers. And, you know, garnering the fact that internships for kids is quite something that has been challenging for these mothers, especially during the summers. It's been a nightmare. And this is...
Can I ask why? What have been the big obstacles or challenges or attitudes that have been getting in the way?
Sure, it's purely because of the reservations that the companies have, the corporates have. You know, everyone looks forward to hiring an intern who's a graduate. Mm-hmm. But we believe that graduation can be the threshold, but internships have to be the beginning. And this is where the gap is in the market.
So it's been a bit of a re-education piece for the companies as well. The demand is there from the students and the families.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. Now, you've got around 30 companies and about 150 internships available this weekend or more.
We are proud. It's 200 plus placements now and 30 plus corporates.
That's amazing.
It's huge. It's an overwhelming response.
Can you give us a bit of a snapshot into some of the industries and what kind of opportunities teens can expect to learn more about and hopefully secure?
Definitely. So we do have various industries. Primarily, we've got IT, we've got real estate, we've got you know, medical as well, which has come on board, which is very rare, but we were very happy to have them on board. And students can look forward to even digital marketing. So we've got a use exposure right there.
Zena, thank you for being with us. As I said, you're grade 11.
Yes.
Have you undertaken any internships yet? Or where do you think that the opportunity for you to, you know, further your professional and academic studies could be through an internship?
Yes, I have done a couple internships before, around one or two. However, as someone that is quite has quite of a wide range, there are a lot of things that I'm interested in. And I think that the best thing about internships is that they provide you with the opportunity to experience all the different things that you're interested in. So you could always love different subjects. However, an internship is what actually makes you realize that you love being in the work environment, you love the professional setting, and you love the people that you work with. And it's really a good and realizer for a student, especially.
It brings it to life, doesn't it?
Yes.
You can talk about jobs, opportunities and skill sets and da-da-da-da-da, but until you're in that workplace and you go, oh gosh, like the dynamic or the energy is not what I was expecting. And it, you know, it's all information. It might be a case of doing an internship and go, gosh, that really isn't for me. But that helps, you know, make more decisions as you move forward, which is going to your point, Vidi, about how important it is for these insights to happen earlier on in a teen's life, rather than going,
absolutely,
oh gosh, I'm going to pay a fortune for university.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to getting the workplace, think, this isn't what I want at all. So it's happening this weekend. Would you mind kind of walking us through the format of the Unihawk Teen Launchpad in terms of this, the flow of the days, and kind of bring it to life for us a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So we start off at 9 o'clock in the morning. We're going to be opening registrations for the children as well as the corporates. They would be coming in. We have sorted out the entire premises. We've divided the place so well. We've got a corporate safari lined up for the children. So it's going to be well defined places. We've got workshops running through the day. And we also have renowned speakers from the industry. So it's very well organized up until 4 o'clock.
This weekend?
This weekend, on a Saturday, 27th April.
Okay, if you've got any questions, you can send me the word teen. We're going to be catching up with Zena and Vidi Moore as we explore this happening. It's happening this weekend, this Saturday. Huge, huge event for teens, in particular age between 15 and 18. If you want to send me the word teen or intern, I will send you the link so you can find out more. But up next, I'm curious about what internship looks like in 2024. Are we talking about a day, a week, a month, or more? What can teens expect to avail opportunity-wise from these fantastic companies coming together this weekend? Talking internships ahead of the Teen Internship Fair. This weekend, the Unihawk Teen Launchpad is happening on Saturday from 9 until 4. We've got founder of RM Events, Vidi Shah, with us today, and joining us, grade 11 student Zena Merchant, who's going to be involved on the day and maybe have an eye on scooping some of those internships as well. Vidi, I wanted to ask you, what does an internship look like? Well, you've got, you know, numerous companies, over 200 internships available. When we're talking about time frame, as Zena said before, it's such a great time opportunity to get an insight into a company. That can't happen in one day, probably can't happen in one week. What's the kind of commitment that some of these companies are willing to put forward to the teenagers?
Definitely. So, you know, I would, before I come down to the commitment, I would like to say that Unihawk Teen Launchpad primarily is a platform to give the teenager an experience, a real world experience, something what you and me would have sat through, you know, and that's exactly what we want the teenager to experience. And just like you said, it's not a one day experience. We want them to feel the whole corporate world. And we feel that primarily 2 weeks up to 2 months would be an ideal time for anyone to intern in a corporate.
One of the big challenges we've heard time and time again for teenagers is lack of opportunity to have those real life insights, lack of opportunity to have a part-time job. And I think this is kind of a really valuable way to meeting those goals, getting some things on the resume, those real life experiences. Zena, are there any particular companies or industries that you're going to be excited to learn more about over the weekend?
I'm honestly excited to look at all of them. Anything that I can learn, I will learn, and I'm so open to everything, particularly maybe some digital marketing. I know that there are workshops happening for that, so I'd really want to kind of open myself up to something like that. Also the medical opportunities. I think that as someone who is really interested in the sciences, that the medical field can give me an eye into kind of all the different branches that there is into science. Mm-hmm. So I'm really looking forward to the medical aspect as well.
Vidhi, I've had a number of people asking how to get involved. Tomorrow is the deadline for completing the registration and payment for every teenager. It's 25 dirhams and they can come with an adult for free. Where can we point people in terms of website for the Launchpad event this weekend?
Sure. So we do have our Instagram handle. I guess social media is the way forward. It's called the RM Events. As soon as they're on the RM Events, they will get all the information, including the registration links.
Perfect. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
And lastly, what advice would you give to teenagers for getting the most out of any opportunities through an internship?
An experience. That's what I would say. And experience is something that I would say they should look forward to.
Well, thank you so much. If you want to send me the word teen or internship, I will send you the link for the RM events so you can register for what's happening this weekend. So you're going to have to be quick. But hundreds of internships available with more than 30 companies here in the UAE. Help your teen get an insight, maybe even get ahead. Thank you both for joining us in the studio.
You're listening to Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, where the number one ingredient is always high-quality salmon, lamb, turkey and chicken.
Tell me, what are your pets' pet hates? What do they really, really find annoying? From the understandable to the totally bizarre, what does your furry friend detest? Tell me on the text line. Our dog Lucy hates the gardener, despite the fact he's been there since she's come home. She hates the windows being washed. And if you offer a piece of cucumber, she'll be show interest because her sibling does. And then she is just revolted. And our dog Jarvis doesn't like people singing at certain pitches. He finds it offensive. What about you? Let me know on 4001 on the app or the WhatsApp and I'll put you into the draw to win a fantastic prize. 3 month supply of ProPlan pet food. And of course, we're here to answer your questions. Dr. Sari Ramsey from Dr. Well Veterinary Clinic on our wassail in the studio. How are you, Dr. Sarah?
Very good, thank you.
Tell us about your menagerie. Who is at home?
Well, it's grown a little bit since I last saw you.
Oh, really? There's a surprise.
Yes. So we still have Snowy, our dog that we bought from the UK, and our two cats, Dexter and Atty. We've added a few more cats to that and a tortoise. So we're now at 11 cats. Yes.
11?
A pregnant stray turned up left us with all her babies.
Oh, gosh. Any weird and wonderful pet peeves amongst your gang?
No, mine are all quite normal sort of hatred. So the storm, the dog Snowy absolutely hates thunder and lightning. So she was an absolute mess last week. The sort of little Arabian male Bengal kittens that we have.
Are they noisy?
They are next level noisy.
Vocal.
But they're into everything. They don't seem to be scared of anything or they will eat everything. They love a bit of carbs. They love a loaf of bread to attack.
They?
Yeah, they're very strange little creatures, but we love them very much.
Bless. Coming back to the storms, it was that was the first thing that kind of alerted to me that there was rain going on because the dog, one of our dogs in particular, could see the lightning, and then it was the noise, and then it was, you know, kind of the anxiety that, you know, was happening in the house, and it was really hard to know how to calm her down. In the end, we brought her into our room and put the blackout blinds down so she couldn't see the lightning, and it was a mess. But for an awful lot of animals, it was very, very distressing. And we should say that, you know, for a lot of families that have been displaced and, you know, there's been these changes or not being able to take care of their pets because of their homes. Well, have you had anything coming into clinic as a bit of a fallout from the floods, Doctor?
We've definitely, I think, seen some stress-related issues. You know, definitely, I would say, yeah, our own dog probably has taken a week to get used to. She didn't really want to go for a walk or anything like that. Mm. And then I think, obviously, yeah, with all the changes in the community, you know, that sort of is a bit strange to them as well. So, you know, we will often advise things like the adaptal plugins or collars that release a synthetic pheromone that can help dogs relax. And there's a similar thing for cats as a plug-in. So those things are very good. And particularly if people have had to move out of their properties and are staying with friends, then those are really good things to put in the house to help reduce anxiety and the fact that things have changed. We've been seeing, unfortunately, quite a lot of vomiting and diarrhoea, which I think is probably related to a lot of the water and stuff that pets are walking through. So I definitely would advise, you know, making sure that you're wiping down their feet and their legs, you know, when they come in the house so that they're not then grooming themselves and making themselves poorly.
We were talking about gastro issues in humans an hour ago. And it was a case of, you know, sometimes these things will pass and, you know, just, you know, rehydrate, have your electrolytes. When it's children and things have gone on for a while, might need, you know, a bit more care and maybe even the hospital. But if an animal, let's use dog as an example, if a dog, which happened to us at the weekend, throws up on the rug, a one-off, fine. When do you need to go and see a vet?
Yep, absolutely. So again, some things, yeah, just like us, it might just be 12, 24 hours and you're okay. With dogs particularly, if they're drinking water and keeping it down, that's fine. If they cannot keep down water, then I would definitely seek veterinary attention because they can become dehydrated very quickly and it goes from being a very simple vet visit to maybe a hospital stay. With cats, if they're not eating, you know, dogs cannot eat for 24 hours. As long as they're drinking water, they'll be fine. Cats are not designed not to eat. Cats should eat little and often throughout the day. So even a cat not eating for 12 hours can make themselves sicker than they were originally. So not eating cat is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Again, if it's a small amount of diarrhea, okay. But if it's profuse and we're having lots or there's blood in it, then definitely a vet visit is worthwhile.
Shake has been in touch here on the text line, which is open now, by the way, so get in touch, saying over the last few weeks we've woken up a few times to find bile on the kitchen floor next to where our dog sleeps. I'm worried that she's going to bed hungry and this is why she's being sick. Should we feed her later?
Yep, so there is a syndrome called sort of bilious regurgitation, which will often happen in animals. Obviously they have a slightly different gastric acid to us because they're predominantly meat eaters. So often if they are being fed a little bit too early, there's all this acid there and they're kind of expecting breakfast to come in the morning and then they'll vomit overnight. So we often find maybe splitting that evening meal, so feeding a little bit of it later on just before bedtime, or a little snack just at bedtime will sometimes stop that.
Who doesn't like a little snack before bedtime? Dr. Sarah Ramsey with us today from Dr. Well Veterinary Clinic. If you've got any questions for her, you can reach out. It could be to do with the health. We've had a few behaviour questions as well on 4001. Do tell me what your pets are called. I've had messages about a dog called Pete, Beryl. We're going to be talking about Beryl next as well. And loving your messages about what your pets hate. Nathan's saying, Harry, Lab Mex, we think, goes mental when the kids play football outside. Also storms, totally understandable. And they're saying, my cat's Snowy, another Snowy, dislikes a wash. Well, again, totally understandable.
You're listening to Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, where the number one ingredient is always high-quality salmon, lamb, turkey and chicken.
Joining us in studio from Dr. Well Veterinary Clinic is Dr. Sarah Ramsey, on hand to take your questions. As we heard earlier, she's got a menagerie of 11, so can draw on her own personal experiences at home, but also years of experience in the clinic as well. And I do love it when you tell me what your pets are called. Lucy's been in touch. She's got a terrier mix called Beryl.
It's just a wonderful name.
Wonderful name. Shout out to Beryl. Almost 18 months. She's obsessed with having stuff thrown for her. If it's not a ball, it's teddies, little scraps of material, anything she can find, and it's driving me demented. She gets loads of exercise, loads of attention. She's a happy, healthy girl. It's been going on for a few weeks. It's constant. She will not just lie down and relax, other than when she's asleep. Does your vet know how I can change this behaviour? It's really difficult to manage. Oh, Beryl, little attention seeker.
Yeah, so obviously don't know exactly what type of terrier mix Beryl is, but particularly if they're more of a working dog, they obviously feel that they have to do a job. So one of those things might be redirecting that energy in a slightly different way. So instead of throwing, hiding and having to go and find things, because that takes longer and requires a bit more sort of, you know,
snuffling
effort
around
and things like that. Mm-hmm. So hiding things and getting her to find them. When it comes to feeding, not just having food in a bowl, but using puzzle feeders, hiding them in boxes, egg cartons, things like that. So again, she's got to, and wrapping material and things around that. So she's got to unwrap it and, you know, and get to the food. So she's, you know, using, you know, sort of natural instincts to find things. And so that takes a lot of brain power and actually quite a bit of energy and things as well. And so takes her time. So I think sort of, yeah, redirecting that, maybe even thinking about, you know, sort of finding somewhere where you can do agility or fly ball. I mean, in the UK, that used to be a big, big thing.
Fly ball?
So fly ball is where they sort of run and a ball is shot out of a thing and they have to grab the ball and run back. And so it's done in a race sort of thing. You'll see
I'm just
it on,
Googling
at Crufts and things like that.
It's a dog sport in which teams of dogs race against each other to start to finish over hurdles to a box that releases a tennis ball to be caught by the dog. This, I mean, my dogs would be so useless at this. I can't even begin. Are there particular breeds that do well in that?
Yeah, a lot of the smaller breeds do. So a friend used to race her Patterdale Terrier, sort of doing that. Yeah, sort of won lots of national competitions.
Gosh,
sort of doing
there
it.
There you go. Fly ball, Lucy. But yeah, more mental stimulation.
Absolutely.
And integrating it to all these different points.
Definitely.
During the day.
And just very, just teaching her lots of different things to do, so various different commands and things like that. So things that she's really, these are really intelligent breeds, so actually sort of giving them a job and things to do. Again, if you're sort of really struggling, I would reach out to an accredited sort of behaviourist and trainer and have some work, sort of one-on-one work with them as well.
Good luck, Lucy. Keep us posted. I obviously want to see a picture of Beryl. You can send that in on WhatsApp, 0487155500. Message from Annie here saying, I've never seen an animal so frightened and desperate than my cat Anoush during the fireworks at Diwali. She was shaking uncontrollably. There was biting. And I could do nothing to help her. So I was ready to see the same during the thunderstorm, but surprisingly, she didn't mind it. But let's not scare our furry ones with fireworks. I always find that often at really random times. I'm like, it's Monday night. It's 9:20. Why are there fireworks? Just as I'm going to bed. But it can be genuinely really distressing. And what we've actually put our dogs into boarding when we know there's going to be fireworks. And I never know if that's us being selfish because, you know, we're not going to be calming them. But when there are people and there's other dogs around, the boarding facilities actually, it can be quite comforting. They quite like that environment. So it's very personal. But yeah, Annie, I am with you. We have got lots to talk about on the show today. Loving your messages on what your pets hate. Tyler says, dog Petey hates balloons. That's actually, I get that one. And a vacuum cleaner. Cyrus asking on 4001, Doctor, should you do different routes, walk to different places every day, or do the same walk with your dog day in, day out? Around our home, there are probably four different routes that you can take around the community. I just wondered if we should be mixing it up. Our dog is three. Love that. And kind of relates to Beryl, actually, in terms of that mental stimulation.
Absolutely. And I think this is probably sort of very animal dependent on the personality of your pet. So my dog, Snowy, she's a rescue dog. She's very much a creature of habit. So she's much happier in going on the same route. So if you take a different route, you can immediately see her anxiety of like, oh, I don't know who I'm going to meet on this route. What is going to happen? So that's whereas another dog would be like, oh, a new route. How exciting kind of thing.
I tried to take our dog in a different direction the other day and she looked at me going, that's not the way we go. And just kind of plonked a bum on the pavement. I was like, okay, we're going that way.
Exactly. Then. And I think, you know, when they've got their nose to the ground and they're sort of wandering along, it's like us reading the paper, or I guess in modern days, scrolling through social media. They're seeing who's been where and when, you know, is that a boy or a girl? Are they on heat? Are they not? You know, that was a cat, that was a head. There's so much, you know, sort of information they get, you know, they're not seeing the same things that, you know, they are obviously seeing the same things that we are, but they see so much more because with their nose to the ground. So they're getting a million times more. So we might think that's a boring, similar walk, but depending on who's actually been on that walk, they're actually getting a lot more from it. So I think it really depends on your, you know, your individual pet, but don't be sort of upset if you're having to do the same one every time, because they're actually getting a lot more out of it than you are.
Cyrus, really interesting question. Thank you so much for that. 4001, if you want to pick the brains of Dr. Sarah Ramsey with us through until 5 o'clock today. It can be to do with health, it can be to do with behaviour. We've got messages about should you separate cats if they're poorly. We've also had messages about thinking about getting a kitten as well. Doreen and the family want some advice. They've always been dog people, but says that my 13-year-old daughter seems to be a cat whisperer. What do we need to have ready to welcome home a rescue? Lovely question, Doreen. We're going to be coming to that.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan.
Joining us in studio, we have got fantastic Dr. Sarah Ramsey from Dr. Well Veterinary Clinic. Ready for some more pet peeves?
Definitely.
Okay. Zoe says, pet hate of Winston the cat, being brushed or indeed touched if it's not on his terms. So I think I've seen this with my kids and the cats before. Oh, just like, you know, pulling the cat over to you and the cat's there like, just want to get away from you as quickly as possible. Ollie says, I love this name, Posh the poodle.
Oh, lovely.
Posh is terribly laid back and nothing bothers him except anything that disrupts his 16-hour sleep pattern. He groans and grumbles and harumphs. Throws himself back down, kicks his legs until he's very much aware of his displeasure and then resumes his slumber. Mohit saying, Simba doesn't like to have his nails cut. Let me know yours. They're a funny lot, these pets, aren't they? Right, so the text line we go, Nikita's been in touch saying, hi both, we've got two cats. They're sisters, they're 1 year old. One is boisterous and cheerful, the other one is a jittery bag of nerves. And the cheerful one bullies the nervy one a bit. Nervy one is currently poorly with stress-induced feline idiopathic cystitis. The vet has suggested she might be happier without her sister. My sister would happily take either of them. I'm just not sure whether it's mean to separate them or whether it would be a kindness. Do cats like living with their siblings or would they be happier alone?
So it's actually something we see very, very commonly, and probably more here because a lot of cats are indoors. So the only cats that actually live in groups are lions. All other cats are solitary. And we as humans make domesticated cats live together. Obviously, I make quite a lot live together.
11 for those of you who've just tuned in.
And, you know, a majority of those are indoor-outdoor cats and four are just sort of indoors. So it's about meeting all of their needs. So there can be no competition for anything. So with litter trays, you need one more litter tray than the number of cats that you have in your house. You need, again, separate feeding stations and spare feeding stations, water all separately. You know, separate scratching posts, separate climbing areas. Particularly cats want to get away from the other cats. So they need to have hiding spaces, places to get up high, to not be touched and bothered by us and things like that, and all their siblings. So, you know, definitely, just like we don't always get on with our siblings, that's the same. And also cats that aren't related can get on very well as well. Unless they're touching noses and grooming each other, they are not in each other's social circle. So you, again, using things like the synthetic pheromones, so fellaway friends can really help reduce that anxiety between sort of cats as well. Again, making sure that there is lots of resources and no competition for anything. And again, maybe diverting that more boisterous cat's energy into, you know, yeah, puzzle feeders, games and things like that. So that energy is directed away from the cat that's more of an introvert and wanting to sort of settle.
Would you suggest maybe trying some of those techniques before separation? And the separation could be a trial separation as
exactly. Well. And I think, you know, definitely some cats are happier, and I have helped, you know, people rehome cats and they've definitely been happier cats for that. Others cats, we have managed to put those things into place and worked out the root cause of their stress, and actually everything has been fine again. Mm. So I don't think you've got anything to lose in trying some of those things. But sometimes actually, unfortunately, it is better for both cats, you know, to just sort of have undivided solitary human attention rather than having a feline companion.
Really hope that helps, Nikita. All the very best, whatever you decide. Thank you, Finn, who's been in touch. And I think this is unfortunately an increasingly common situation, just saying Maple was dumped in my building, pregnant with ear mites, blood parasites. She's now spayed. I'm taking the vet for tomorrow for check-up and vaccination, but she is looking for a new home if anyone is interested. So if you are looking to add, in fact, that brings me nicely to a message we've had from Doreen and family. Thank you, Finn, for reminding me. Doreen has said, we're looking to adopt a kitten, trying to do as much research as possible. I've always been a dog owner, but our daughter, age 13, seems to be a cat whisperer. Can you please give me advice on what to have ready and how to make the first few weeks as easy as possible for our new family member? Also, how to get them to use litter tray for the first time. We'll be indoor, but supervise access to a high fenced garden. Interesting. Right.
Sounds like there's a perfect home waiting there for somebody.
I may connect you.
And definitely there are so many cats here needing homes, so it's lovely that they're looking to adopt. So the International Society of Feline Medicine, so the ISFM, has a brilliant website, and they have some great client handouts on introducing a kitten to your home, and particularly even if you're introducing a kitten into a household that already has a cat or a dog in it as well. So that'd be one of the first places I would go. There's lots and lots of stuff on there. In terms of getting ready, they will use a litter tray themselves. Cats are amazing. So again, we often have kittens, street cats brought into the clinic. They've never ever seen a litter tray. They will use it immediately in
what?
The thing. Yep, their cats are fastidiously clean. So the texture of the litter, they know that should be somewhere they should go and cover it up. So you don't really need to teach them. Mums will teach kittens, but they will often just know how to do it themselves. It's quite impressive.
That's amazing.
So definitely having, again, like I said before, you need one more litter tray than the number of cats that you have. So have two, because they'll like to wee in one and poo in the other. Again, you know, a nice sort of little bed or somewhere they can hide. A cat scratching post and things as well, or one of these sort of cat castle-y sort of things that they can climb on. And again, you know, sort of two food and water stations. You don't want water near food, so they should be further away. A water fountain is really good, encourages them to drink a lot more. That would be your sort of basic setup. But yeah, I would go head on to the ISFM website because that will have the best information for you.
Really, really hope that helps. Fantastic advice. And thank you so, so much for that question, Doreen. Hopefully encouraging others to open doors to some of the furry friends that really are in need right now. I saw an awful lot of pictures of cats giving birth in cars over the last week and, you know, really trying to find a safe space. So there are a lot of animals that do need a helping hand. And Finn, well done for all of your hard work there on little Maple. We've got a question from Layla here saying, we're a week and a half in since rehoming Freddy the cat and he's gorgeous. The only problem is he's starving all the time. He hoovers his wet food in the morning, then inhales the dry food which he's supposed to graze on all day. I don't want to overfeed him, especially when he's not really going outside right now. Any ideas?
So this is definitely going back to puzzle feeders or feeding balls where he's got to move the ball around or he's got to move things around to get to the biscuits. Because particularly, I don't know his background, but if he was a street cat or he had to survive outside at any point, the way you do that, and the most successful ones, are greedy. And it's actually shown that mothers pass on a greedy gene to their offspring. So it is actually a genetic trait that's passed on because, yeah, if you're greedy and you're good at finding food and very good at eating it very quickly, you will live, whereas other ones won't. So it's a survival mechanism. So by definitely, you know, sort of things like licky mats as well, so where you really squish the food on and he's actually got to work at getting out rather than just sitting at a bowl and eating it really quickly. Yeah, the puzzle feeders, balls, things, anything to slow him down, and even like again hiding the food around the house and making him work for it, and that should hopefully slow him down, and then he'll actually feel full rather than cramming it all in one go.
Yeah, I do that. I had a question from Elisa, which has just come in this second, so apologies for springing this on you, saying, what can cats be allergic to? She says, some of my rescue cats have chronic sneezing and I don't know how to rule out what it can be, given we've got 20. They're all up for adoption, but I'd like to address why they're sneezing, coughing so often and what I can give them to manage the symptoms. Allergy tests for so many rescues are really expensive. Does anything come to mind there, Doctor?
Yeah, so that can be a number of things. So if we've sort of addressed the allergy issue, so particularly, you know, sort of harsh chemicals, perfumes, things like that can be a big problem. Molds, particularly in this country with the air conditioning. So sort of making sure that wherever they're staying, you know, that's been sort of looked at. Again, a lot of rescue cats here, we see a large amount of caliche virus, herpes virus, and sort of immunosuppressive diseases as well. So sometimes if they've ever come across a disease like that, they can actually be a chronic carrier of it. Mm-hmm. So any sort of little trigger or stress can sometimes cause that to flare up. So, you know, definitely kind of looking at the environment and sort of seeing if you can make that a lower allergen environment will definitely help. Dehumidifiers and things like that can be good too. But sometimes you actually maybe need to do a little bit more testing and just make sure that some of these cats aren't carrying something like caliche or herpes.
Which presumably can spread very quickly in a colony.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We've run out of time. We have run out of questions. For anyone that wants to come and see you in real life, where can we find you?
So I'm co-owner of Dr. Well Veterinary Clinic and we're at 1084 Alwassel Road. So we're just near the Almanara sort of turn off where the big Costa coffee is.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.